you can try to convince the market of what you're trying to do and bend people to see the world as you see it. And we really don't go that way. Our way is this: communicate clearly what you're trying to accomplish, what you're doing. And, you know, either people like it or they don't. They, you know, come one, come all, come none. And all three options are fine by us.
Welcome to the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, where you get multifamily investing made real. Learn from top players in the real estate investment world as they share their secrets with you and discover proven strategies on apartment investing that actually work. To learn more about Wheelbarrow Profits, visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. Now to your hosts, Jake and Gino.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Senziano, host of the Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father of six, the best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbo. Gino, how's it going?
Mr. Stenziano, I'm doing great. We got a fellow Floridian on the podcast today. I'm loving it.
Uh-oh.
He's got the nice tan like myself. He's been out during this pandemic, so we're going to get some words of wisdom today, my friend.
All right. Talk some sunscreen. You know, we're doing everything today.
A little vitamin D action.
We got a special guest today. Today's guest is Ryan Smith of Elevation Capital Group. Ryan was drafted by the majors. Major League Baseball to Major League Real Estate. Here we go. But opted for entrepreneurship. His group focuses on manufactured housing and self-storage. Elevation, through its affiliates, has acquired properties worth more than $475 million. So without further ado, Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, I was on my Instagram last night. I was seeing these like old clips of Jeter, and I was like, "Oh man, where's the baseball at?" So give us a little background here. I see the show notes here. I see the Major League Baseball. What teams were you drafted for? And man, you couldn't hang in there just for, you know, a little bit before you opted out for real estate.
I couldn't. I'm 6'8", 280. I was a pitcher. Always, you know, liked baseball, liked sports. Had a knack for throwing hard. Through mid 90s, never knew where the ball was.
The heater.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So anyway, played sports, started a software company in high school. It's kind of entrepreneurial. Started coding at around 10. Started a software company to help my dad's real estate business. And so built the software company all the way through college. In high school, got drafted by the Baltimore Orioles obviously a pitcher. Decided not to forego my education. So I ended up going to school, playing all the way through, played for Oregon State for a bit. Didn't like the weather, a little rainy, a little dreary, wanted some vitamin D. So I came back to Florida, ended up graduating for University of Tampa. And I got drafted a couple of times along the way. So Baltimore Orioles and Anaheim Angels.
Did you do any, like, any minors?
No, I had the opportunity to, I just didn't sign. I wanted to pursue business instead.
Could you have struck out Tebow? You know, I think he's in Double A right now. Was that happening?
I haven't thought about it. That would have been a fun challenge.
So, a couple questions. First of all, Baltimore. That's probably why he didn't go to the majors, Jake, because you just don't want to get drafted by Baltimore. Get stuck with Baltimore. I think the second.
Hey man, Camden's a nice field. You got the crab cakes right there, Phillips. You know, there's some things there. All right?
Dude, they're killing me, dude. You're gonna play against the Yankees. You're never gonna win. You know, so what are the similarities between major league sports and specifically baseball and being an entrepreneur in business? There've got to be a lot of similarities to it.
Yeah, I would say a lot. A lot happens outside of the public eye. All the magic happens in quiet places, you know, it's very similar. So there's the glitz and the glam and that's not kind of where the magic happens, so to speak. So, I'd say, you know, the self-discipline, the belief in yourself, curiosity on what potential you hold and have and what that might look like and curiosity about the future. In baseball, it's an unbelievable gamble. Because it's all or nothing. It's either you make it to the major leagues or you're a landscaper. I mean, I'm teasing, of course, but it's a pretty big gamble.
So you're talking about the future. Were you smart enough to know that there's going to be a pandemic and that they weren't going to be able to work and not going to be able to have a job? And you're like, okay, I see this coming. I'm not going to the baseball. I'm going to control my own future and get into real estate that way. Is that what happened, Ryan?
Yeah. Everybody who knows me, who's listening to this right now, is cracking up at the question. I don't even need a reply. So of course not. But yeah.
So how did you get into real estate? I mean, I saw your dad at his company. Did you start working with your dad once you got out of the software company?
So it was family business growing up, you know, peeling, you know, probably the most poignant memory was replacing a wax ring on a toilet when I was around 8. So, you know, that was our family business. That was our contribution on the weekends. Every weekend we were at a different rental property, scraping and digging and trenching and whatever it was. Then I showed a penchant for financial analysis. I like to write software, do those things. So I did a lot of my dad's financial analysis, and fearing that he would never let me out of the home or the basement, I should say, I thought I should probably write him a software application so that he can sit down and do it for himself, so that I might be able to leave. And so that's basically what I did. So really all growing up, that's all I could remember was real estate, properties, you know, different aspects.
And Ryan, would you classify your dad as, was it a mom and pop shop, or was he expanding, getting to more unit, more properties?
Definitely mom and pop. Yeah, definitely mom and pop. I mean, it was, my dad's an incredible story. You know, a roofer turned, you know, he basically was a roofer and realized he, the person who owned the, or made the most amount of money was the one who owned the roof, not the one on the roof. So he started buying roofs, basically. You know, came from a dirt floor poor family. And so anyway, he's a hero of mine. And he built a portfolio of about 50 assets, but it was generally still mom and pop.
So I have a similar story with my dad being a mom and pop. Can you see, I'm just trying to, how can I phrase this question? You go back years ago, they could make an amazing lives for themselves for having 20 or 30 single family homes. What do you think's changed now? Because someone having that portfolio now might be doing okay, but he's not going to live the lifestyle that your dad or even my dad had. My dad had one restaurant and there was four partners in that restaurant. And we lived a really upper middle class lifestyle for, you know, when I, you know, my teen years into my, for that one asset. And your dad did the same thing. Why do you think we need to scale up right now and buy bigger assets and get into more deals to live the same lifestyle that your dad and my dad did?
Well, I think to a degree it's timing. So I know with my dad, there were a lot of deals that I remember when he was acquiring, he wasn't sure. This could either end great or poorly, and he wasn't sure, but he rolled the dice and took the chance. Mm-hmm. You know, in 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years in, you know, that margin started to thicken, you know, and it provided that lifestyle. But generally, what I've noticed, and it's the same now, you know, if you buy a quality asset at scale in a major metro, you know, it may take 5 to 10 years for those margins to really, you know, thicken. And that's typically just beyond most people's patience. Mm-hmm. People want their capital back in, you know, years 1 to 6, years 1 to 7, maybe. But just on the other side of that is where, you know, really the magic happens, and people generally don't have that kind of patience today. We want more faster.
So how do you broach that gap with the investors? Because that's what we want to do. We want to start a fund that actually does a return of capital and is a long term. Because Jake and I were looking back at our assets and it's amazing. Like you said, year one, $0. Year two, $18,000. Year three, all of a sudden we refied our first two deals and we've got all that money back. Year four, it's like explosion, right? And we're doing it. This is a secondary gig for us because we're doing our you know, our restaurant and our pharmaceutical job full time. And we knew our why. Our why was strong enough. We were clear enough. So, I mean, how do you convey to the investors, hey, this is where the magic starts if we hold these things long term?
Yeah. So I think there's, and I'll start by saying we just closed our seventh fund about a month ago when we ended up raising about $150.4 million, at least in terms of commitments.
How much?
About 150.4 was the committed capital. Right now we're at about 140 million. Or
150 million, everybody. So I think you should listen to his answer because I think he's got some great answers.
Yeah, no, and there's nothing magical because we've, you know, there's two parts to it. You could either, as somebody who's raising capital, you can try to convince the market of what you're trying to do and bend people to see the world as you see it. And we really don't go that way. Our way is this: communicate clearly what you're trying to accomplish, what you're doing. And, you know, either people like it or they don't. They, you know, come one, come all, come none. And all three options are fine by us, but this is where we're going. This is why we think it's the best way to go. And whoever, you know, wants to go that way can come with us. But to your point, I mean, really in our first four funds, you know, one of the most, you know, especially our first fund, you know, I was 29 years old. You know, I raised $2 million. This is in, you know, 2009, right? In the height of the, you know, Great Recession. I'm 29. and going to my friends and family and saying, hey, we, you know, I thought of you, and then we're going to go buy mobile home parks, and who wants to join me? You know, my wife's 27, I'm 29. We have a bright idea to go buy mobile home parks. And we had owned mobile home parks for a number of years at that point privately. But anyway, it was a daunting task. One of the original questions was, how quick am I getting my money back? You know, it's a reasonable question, which, just to be candid, it's most of the investors saying, I like you, but I don't know how this, you know, I don't quite trust the process yet. It was a trust issue more than anything. So, we've structured it so that the capital would come back in roughly 5 to 7 years, you know, mm-hmm. And the irony is, as time went, people got distributions, they liked the process, they trust the process. And now we start, to your point, to sell and create liquidity and start returning capital to investors. A lot of investors said, whoa. You know, I changed my mind. I trust you now. You know, I trust you now. But unfortunately for them, the ink had dried, and they could then redeploy it into what we internally call a version 2.0 fund, which our last fund was, and mm-hmm. we'll be opening a new fund here probably within the next month or so. And that will also be same kind of version 2.0 fund.
So we're talking about raising $140 million for your seventh fund. What did that first real estate deal look like?
For yourself, your own
first real estate deal. Let's go back to that. I should have asked that sooner, but I got caught into that $140 million. I was like, oh, I got to hear this story.
So first deal was around, 2003 for me. My wife and I, we were dating at the time, and we came together and started building. I talked her out of becoming a lawyer. She wanted to go to law school. And I said, hey, let's build something together. And she trusted me enough, and which was pretty awesome. But anyway, we right off the bat, roughly 2003, I think we ended up buying around 30 single family houses with the goal of long, like my dad, buy, rent them out, over 30 years, the tenants pay it off. If it goes up, it goes up. And, and so we thought at 30, you'd get some scale, you'd get some margin improvement, and that mm-hmm. didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so at or around 30, we just said, there's got to be a better way to forward. So we spent time, and we did a model on all the different asset classes that we were interested in: apartment complexes, office, retail, industrial, billboards, raw land, land banking, mobile home park storage. And what we were looking for were four things. We wanted cash flow, we wanted capital appreciation, we wanted tax benefits, and then we wanted, to the extent possible, non-correlation or cycle resiliency, low beta. If the market goes crazy, we didn't want to go equally crazy, so to speak. We wanted off the roller coaster ride. So the two things that we basically created a model for each one of these asset classes, and our thought was, whichever one, we'll throw them on the table, let them duke it out, and whichever one's the best, we'll pursue. And the two best that we found, based on our analysis at the time, were storage and mobile home parks. In terms of NOI growth, which has a cash flow and a value creation component, those were the two. And, all these years later, we're still sticking with it.
So everyone write that down. Number one is cash flow. Number two is capital appreciation. Number three is tax benefits. And number four is cycle resiliency, low beta. And I think Ryan's smiling right now because during this pandemic, I think he's got it all. As Jake likes to say, if it don't cash flow, let the grass grow. So it's one of our mantras. And what we've been talking about, let's buy an actuals for the last 2 years. And people have been saying, Jake and Gino, you're crazy, underwriting 300 deals, getting two deals last year, thinking, what am I doing wrong? It ain't cash flowing, right? I mean, all the other stuff is fine. You're going to get appreciation. You're going to get tax benefits. And we do have that cycle resiliency because our collections have been doing really well for the last 3 months. And it seems like we're in an okay spot. But for us, it was the same thing. Jake, you want to jump in for a second?
No, I think it's completely right. It's just finding, a lot of people are like, well, what kind of asset class do I want to be in? And I think it's picking the vehicle that aligns with what you're trying to achieve. What are your values? What are the goals you're trying to get to? And that's why, for us, multifamily works really well, and we're comfortable just staying in our lane and keeping it boring. And it sounds like, Ryan has a similar mentality with the assets that he enjoys.
Mm-hmm. And Ryan, I want to be a fly on the wall. When you told your dad, I'm going to start a fund, what did your dad say to you?
Well, I mean, truthfully, I didn't even really fully know what a fund was when I had a friend tell me about it. So I think he and I were both in the same boat. He was excited about it, had never done one, didn't really fully understand it. Nor did I. So the apple didn't fall from the tree, so to speak. But, But I had a good friend of mine, or somebody who's now been become a really good friend of mine, who at the time I met him was probably 68 years old. I think he had 55,000 units that he owned and operated at the time. I think I had 1,000 or so. And he took me under his wing to a degree in my mid-20s and said, hey, you should really consider a fund. I had no idea what a fund was. I didn't know what that word meant. So anyway, if it wasn't for him really pushing me in the right direction conceptually, I probably wouldn't have figured it out.
How did your dad help you along the journey?
Oh, man, a lot of different ways. I just think that the story about my dad that I probably most respect is just his work ethic. You know, and it's all the eye roll, you know, boring. It's nothing sexy, but it is. It's the showing up and doing the work when everybody else is, you know, griping and complaining and bad things are happening. The story that, you know, I remember, my dad got royally screwed in a business deal when I was young. And it got to the point where we all were literally sleeping on mattresses in our house because we got royally taken to the cleaners, he did. And so rather than moping about it, we're all suffering and, you know, all of this stuff. And, you know, I'm sure uncertainty and he wasn't doing well. But he ended up to make some money. He got a job at a friend of mine, business, sweeping out his houses at the end of the day after, you know, the construction crews would come in and renovate a house. My dad would actually go in, from 5 to 9 or 10 o'clock at night, sweep it out, broom it out. And so we would go pick him up at 10 o'clock, bring him back to the house. And, you know, that was the way he put food on the table for that very, gratefully, a very limited time. And my dad went on from there and did incredibly well. But the point is, when the chips were down, he was brooming out a house far beneath, you know.
Stepped it up.
Yeah, it's far beneath who he is today, but it's not far beneath what he's willing to do, which I
love that.
It speaks more than all the platitudes.
So this is important for all you dads out there. We are role models for our kids, and our kids see us, and it's not embarrassing to have your dad do work. And you look at it a certain way as a dad going, I can't believe I'm sweeping this house out, but your child, your son, your daughter will see that as he's my hero because he's willing to do anything. And that'll translate into the next generation, because I always say work hard. Everyone says work smart and work with passion. The Trinity is to work. You need to work hard, because if you don't have that work ethic in you, you're going to crumble at the first sight of something going wrong. You're starting your first fund. All of a sudden, you can't convince a few people and you're just going to quit, right? No, you just figure out. You find a mentor who's done it before. So it's really important. The work ethic is one of the most important things in this business. And that's one of the things that I took away from my restaurant. So our fathers are probably very similar in that, I mean, you work out long hours. You work tough hours. You work long days. You deal with a lot of people. I was at a restaurant last night, and ladies driving the people crazy because their food's hot. It's cold. I'm like, lady, just shut up. You're lucky that we're out. They just open the restaurants and you're complaining. You know what I'm saying?
They probably have one person in the back cooking, right?
I'm like, dude, would you give me a break already? So I'm just saying it's such a difficult profession to be in. And, you know, like I said to all you dads out there, it's not embarrassing if you're going through something tough. Just show up for your kids and make them understand that, hey, listen, we'll do anything we have to get through it. So that's really important for me. So Ryan, when you started the first fund, what was the progression between the first one and the sixth or seventh one? What are the differences you've seen from starting the first one to the ones you're starting right now?
Yeah, there's been a lot. So our first funds, obviously our first fund was February 2010. So that was a Reg D 506B, as in boy, offering. Mm-hmm. September 23rd of 2013, Reg D 506C was kind of birthed.
Hey Ryan, are these like children? Like, you know their birthdays, huh? They're like special little kids to you, huh?
I know about the funds. I know about the people in each fund, and it's a lot of fun. I mean, I really enjoy it. So our first two funds were Reg D 506B, friends and family. And then September 23rd, we were allowed to do a C offering, a Reg D 506C, which then allows for general solicitation. Mm-hmm. With our B offerings, we never did non-accrediteds. You're allowed 35. We did not go that route. We actually had a lady, I think in fund two, she, you know, it's self-attestation, you know, and she said, well, I'm not accredited. But I'll just say that I am. And you lost the shot and didn't take her. Mm-hmm. But anyway, really from fund three on, it's been Reg D 506C with general solicitation. So the first two funds were going to friends and family. So Jamie and I sat at our kitchen, A to Z in our phone, you know, just thankfully we never hit Z, you know, and raised the capital that way. Really with fund three, we started opening it up to a larger outside pool. Mm-hmm. Our first step there was to, you know, really do more of an event model where you, you know, lunch and learn, or you bring people in, you tell the story to a degree and go that route. But over time, I just started thinking, you know, I started realizing that there's people who are looking for me every day. They want somebody who's going to work hard, integrity, all the low hanging fruit, all the stuff that you should have, right? Mm-hmm. But are also experienced and competent and have a team and, you know, some know-how. And so anyway, we started basically, rather than the way I think of it, rather than having a person walking down the street and you jump out of the bushes and say, hey, wait, stop. Let me tell you why what I do is the best thing you'll ever hear. That's the live event model. We just thought, you know, we're gonna put a sign up and people who walk by, if they read it and they want to call, they call. And so anyway, around 2014, 2015, we started jumping in front of people who were looking for us, so to speak. And today we have about 18,000-ish accredited investors that have now come to us, requested information, no list purchase or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And so people who now know our story, like us, and for whatever reason want to keep hearing from us. So,
how'd you do that? You like billboards? You do mailers? What was the marketing strategy?
I've done a ton of all of those things. I mean, we haven't done billboards. I will admit we haven't done billboards. But, you know, we've done digital advertising. We've done radio. We've done newspaper. We've done direct mail, in all shapes and sizes and configurations. We've done big events with 2,000 people, you know, and had Sarah Palin and, you know, Ben Stein and Giuliani and Steve Forbes come in. You know, I've done small events. I've done medium events. I've tried a bunch of different things, and all have their role and all have their place. It depends on what you're trying to do, where you're going. And now we're grateful because now we feel like we have all these arrows in our quiver. And depending on what we're trying to do, we pull a certain arrow back. And at sometimes, like right now, we have several marketing channels that are sitting dormant, but each one would work if we just pulled it off the shelf. So now that's been our goal over the last couple of years, is build out excess capacity for exact times like this. So we wanted to diversify our channel when we didn't need to, so that we had that when we did need it. And so last 2 years we've been doing that.
I love that. So if I'm starting out and I've done, you know, one or two syndications and I've got a decent sized portfolio, could you give me steps on how to, you know, what would the framework look like for me to, hey, I want to start a fund. What would you recommend?
So first decide, I mean, and to be very candid, a fund is not the end all be all for all people. Mm-hmm. In some cases, one-off deals done with excellence are a lot better than scaling. I mean, I know there's an ego component to scale, and we all want, you know, the unit count and the 10,000 and, you know, all of that, whatever that happens to be. But first decide if that's actually something you want to do, if it's worth the risk reward. But then when you're forming a fund, you know, you need to decide obviously which kind of fund you're doing, a B or a C. There's different components to each one. We like the C. We don't do non-accredited investors anyway. So for us, there's no reason to not do a C. And then within the C, there's the marketing plan, you know, as Jake said earlier, of what's your budget, you know, how much are you looking to raise? Like I talked to a gentleman yesterday from Dallas who's looking to form a fund, and he's looking to raise $2 million. Well, $2 million, if you have really $2 million is probably in your Rolodex in your phone. I mean, now, if you go through it and you don't, then there may be some other issues, you know, trust issues. But just to be blunt, it's in your phone. And if it's not, the marketing won't be the problem, mm-hmm. But then again, if you're trying to raise 10 million plus 20, 30, 40, you're definitely going to need to scale with a proactive marketing plan. I would say not only a marketing strategy, but a clear communication strategy. Because what I see is a lot of people bring people in as leads or, you know, do their different initiatives, and then they just die on the vine. And so how are you communicating or dripping on those folks on a regular basis? That's that's varied and multifaceted. And so anyway, just really articulating what that looks like, applying a budget to it, building out a communication strategy. And then lastly, making sure your whole model is incredibly compliant. I see a lot of stuff today that it makes me cringe, but we're known to be very conservative.
So let me before we go to the short answers, Jake, let me just rehash that for everybody. The first one, decide if a fund is right for you, right? Do you want to scale? As we like to say, Jake and Gino, revenue is vanity, profit margin is sanity, and cash is king. And a lot of the operators out there are seeing that right now. You know, people keep asking me, what is your goals? What are your unit target amounts? And Jake and I like to say, we don't mind doing a couple deals a year. A couple of really good deals a year will set you for life and to continue to grow it, because we're vertically integrated. And we know as we start scaling and adding on, we're going to have to start hiring more and more people. And it's going to put, you know, stresses on our systems. But we like to be vertically integrated because we control the asset and it's an easier sell to our investors. And it's just, we're more profitable that way. So do we want to have 6,000 units? Yeah, probably. But I mean, I'd rather have 3,000 and do a better job with 3 than 6. So there's no right or wrong answer. So that's a really excellent point. Decide if it's right for you. The second one, do you want to do 506B or C? You want to have non-accredited or accredited investors? That's an important factor. The third one is the marketing plan, the budget you need to spend, which is really important. The next one is, what is the raise? How much are you going to raise for it? Next one is the communication strategy. And finally, as Ryan said, he's a stickler. The model has to be compliant. Are you being compliant? And make sure you hire a great team of syndication attorneys, CPAs, and make sure that you've got it. You know, before you do this, you have to have the model tested. We're the mom and pop kings. We're going to continue to buy what we're buying. Ryan is going to be buying mobile home parks and self-storage. We're not going to go out and buy a commercial, you know, office on our first deal with the fund. We're going to stick with our model, which, you know, we've been improving for the last 6 years. So that's really important.
Yeah. So, and on the compliance, what I mean by that, to be more specific, is, and this is more of a theme that I notice, is really the question is, when you're putting together a fund and people are making an investment decision in your fund, ultimately they're deciding on the team. They're deciding on you. You know, that's their, you know, people are investing in you, Jake, and you, Gino, when they're investing. It's not any other. What a lot of people I've noticed do is, when they're starting a fund, they try to create all of this collateral material paraphernalia to basically say, don't look at me, look at that. Because it's almost as if they don't think they'll survive the scrutiny or their backstory or whatever it is. So they create all of these models and all of these packages that, and they're basically raising capital by creating expectations of outcomes in the hopes that people don't actually look at you in the eye and you know, question your story and capability and integrity and, you know, all of those things. So I, you know, our whole thing is, and especially in today's market, you know, the fund is a ship. The ship is, or the vehicle is important, but not nearly as important as the captain and crew. Mm-hmm. You know, so I would, as you're raising, make sure the focus is always where it needs to be and not try to divert it to other aspects of consideration. So, and there's a lot of compliance things that go into that, but that's generally what I notice.
Before I get to the short answer questions, my last one is, what were the benefits for you to start a $2 million fund? Instead of saying, hey, I'm just going to do a syndication, one-off, raise $2 million, what were those benefits that you saw in starting a fund that small?
Yeah, well, and it's funny to go back. That was huge. I mean, I was petrified over a $2 million fund.
No, I'm not saying it's not. That is a lot of money. No, I just was wondering, you know, we've done our first raise was $2.6 million. We did it in 48 hours. It was really quick because we had the investor base. It was our first syndication. And I look back at it, I'm like, I don't know if I would have started a fund at that level. So I'm just wondering, I want the listeners to hear, what are the benefits of starting something that small? And is it okay to start that small, or should I just do a one-off syndication? So.
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question on what the threshold is, so to speak, you know, what the tipping point is. For me, going back to that first fund, it was 6 mobile home parks that we bought for about $5 million. So I would not have been able to buy those assets personally had I not done a fund. Mm-hmm. However, looking back on just that fund, I probably would have been better just personally buying one or two assets as opposed to those, you know, those 6 assets, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But then what that did is then I figured it out. I scaled. I got a little bigger, a little bigger, a little bigger. So now in the whole, what I've learned, it's far better now But taking that first fund and saying, was that the best path? If that was all there was, it wouldn't have been, which is why my advice is start by understanding, is this, where are you going with this? Like, where do you want it to go? Because a fund is not necessarily the end all be all.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, gang, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
Gino, I know a lot of our listeners are wanting to take their multifamily investing business to the next level. I know that you've been hard at work helping Jake and Gino students do just that using our framework. Can you explain to the listeners how they can get our help?
Guys, we've been hard at work growing our community of like-minded investors, and the results of our members has been nothing short of.
All right, we are back. What is your best habit for success? Something that you personally do that has made you successful?
You know, that's a good question. I would say there's a group of guys, 12 guys that I'm a part of. There's a group that's formed kind of in the vein of the Inklings, which is C.S. Lewis and J.R. Tolkien. And they used to get together, have a beer and debate. And they learned how to be agreeably disagreeable. And so there's a group of 12 guys here in town that we meet quarterly and we debate.
And it's over Middle Earth?
Well, get him started, please.
Most of the time. No, but it actually varies about, it could be business, it could be philosophy. But what that group has taught me is really how to, number one, seek an outside opinion how to learn how to be agreeably disagreeable. And so that has been a sharpening experience for me.
That's a
lot. So you're having conversations. Yeah, no, you're having conversations where you're like, you can disagree on something, debate, and walk away friends.
Correct. And it's,
which is not common these days, right?
No, it's not. And it's there's some intense and opposing views that are shared, but to your point.
Ryan, I think your other skill or your other strength that you do is you show up at the office. You're there. You've been, the last 6 weeks we were talking about everything shut down. I can see a beautiful view outside your window. You're in the office every day. So that work ethic is translated. So that's a skill, everybody. Showing up every day and going to work and taking responsibility is a huge daily task.
Agreed.
What's your best tip for the listeners when scaling?
Great question.
Yeah. Do it right. Excellence is the key. Don't compromise quality and excellence for scale. If you have to pick one or the other, stick with excellence. Scale without excellence is fruitless.
Can you give us an example of that? I mean, as far as
you don't get caught up in Instagram and Facebook right now, because everyone's like, I just did 8 million units. And you're like, well, I have to do 8 million units. So then I know you're not asking me the question, but that's the first thing that popped in my head, is everyone gets all this social media pressure that I got to be the biggest, thing out there. And then they try to force deals because they feel like so-and-so just closed 500 units. Why am I not closing 500 units? I think that's something we see a lot these days.
Yeah. I attended a conference this year where I was speaking at it, and I told, my wife, who was there, and a friend of mine, I almost left after the first day because there was such an oppression. There was such a heaviness in all the attendees as they felt this pressure to be the biggest, the most units, the most AUM. And none of that matters at all. I mean, none of it matters, just do it well. Gino, your point earlier, 6,000 versus 3,000, it's do it with excellence. So I guess an example would be on the capital raise side of things, there's probably a lot of things you can do to raise a lot more money quickly that are not compliant, not right. And ultimately, compliance is, really protecting the investor. It's not in the best interest of the investor in terms of their understanding or their conceiving the risk rewards of what they're investing in. So don't compromise that. I mean, if you only raise $2 million as opposed to $10 million, $2 million right, you will be very, very glad in the long run.
And you'll be sleeping at night. And it's good to sleep at night. Yeah. Sure. What about a book recommendation?
Ooh, that's a good question. So Right Away and All at Once was written by a good friend of mine, Greg Brenneman, who was a former president of Continental Airlines, who turned it around. And it was actually the foundation of TPG, the private equity firm. Bonderman bought Continental, took it private. My friend Greg Brenneman and Gordon Bethune took it over and turned it around. But anyway, Greg wrote a book called Right Away and All at Once that was really quite good.
Nice. What project are you excited about right now?
All of them. I mean, every single one of our funds is a puzzle piece, and it's fun kind of continuing to put the puzzle together. But the puzzle we're putting together right now is on fund, you know, what we'll likely call Fund 8, because we're incredibly creative in our naming schemes. We got a huge marketing department. So anyway, we're putting the finishing wraps on that. So that'll be fun to see how that comes to fruition.
Well, with that being said, what has been your most successful marketing strategy to raise money?
You know, I really think it's been kind of a slow ground game, and that we've been really consistent over a long time. We have about, you know, 10 to 15 people a day request information from our site. And then I communicate constantly with people and tell them what we're doing, not for better or for worse. You know, as you said, with Instagram and none of the hyperbole or the fluff and the everything's up and to the right, you know, just be balanced in our communication. So, so that's helpful. I also give a lot of people the opportunity to connect, me with them and them with me, in the field. I'm constantly visiting properties. And so when I'm at a property, I'll email all the people in that area and say, hey, if you want to do a walk and talk, you know, we call them walk and talks. Very, again, very creative in our naming scheme. You know, you show up, you walk and talk. But, you know, I'm constantly traveling. It gives people an opportunity to get to know me and me to know them. And we know, I mean, thousands of our investors really well, which is probably the part I enjoy the most is the people.
All right. So if someone wants to give some cash here and they want to contribute to Fund 8, how do they do that?
Oh, well, they can. Well, it sounds like there's going to be a fund with you guys as well. So I'm sure they know how to do that. And they can find out information by going to elevationfund.com. There's a splash page there where they can put their information in. And as soon as it's launched, they'll get an email.
So Gino, you have the focus here. You can find a good operator that knows what they're doing, or you can get the Sears or the JCPenney Christmas catalog with all the shiny toys in it and go through that. So I think this is a clear and defining moment here. Focus on the operator versus the Penny's catalog with all the toys in it, right?
Jake, I'm going to jump in here because I got a lot of recap going on here, because this has been really a learning lesson, I think, for all the listeners. So the first thing is people work with people, I'm going to give two cliches, who know, like, and trust. So that know, like, and trust takes a long time, right? It's not what you say to people. It's how you make them feel, right? You can say to them, hey, you know, I want to go short term. I want a long term. You got to make them feel comfortable with going through the long term model. So those two are really important. They resonate really greatly. The four about the asset is really, I'm going to have to repeat that again for everybody. It's about cash flow. It's about capital appreciation. It's about tax benefits. And it's about cycle resiliency. What a great word. That's what people have to start putting in their pitch deck and start pitching, because that's the status role right there. When you're pitching somebody for Oren Klaff's book from Flip the Script, you say those four things to somebody, why are you going to be in the stock market down 30%? You have total control, and this is why I'm investing in these assets. You give them those four, they'll be like, what did he just say? He must know what he's talking about, right? You have to really understand what you're investing in. And, you know, I'd love to go through those six again with the 506B with the fund. I think that's important. It just really makes total sense to me. Decide if it's right for you. Is it a 506B or C? The marketing plan. Figure out your marketing plan, your budget. What is the raise that you want to do? Communication strategy is really important. And finally, is the model compliant? Get team members on your team.
He's a student of the game, Ryan. What can I say?
You know, it's just people have to be told a couple times, because I think it's really important. I should also end with this, Jake, too. It's really important that Ryan said this. It doesn't matter about how many units you have. It's how well you're doing it and why are you doing it. You know, you don't need to have 10,000 units to have a really great life. A couple hundred units will do great. Ryan's dad did a great job with a couple hundred, you know, 50 assets, he said. My dad did the same thing, well, in restaurant. It really depends on what you want in life and being clear. And I think being present for your kids and being a role model, first and foremost, if you're a family person, for your children. And if not, just be a role model for anybody out there who's looking up to you, whether it's your team members, whether it's your employer or your employees, whoever it is, just be that role model out there.
Agreed.
Amen. Ryan, thank you so much for your time today.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ryan.
We trust that you enjoy the Wheelbarrow Profits podcast. Visit jakeandgino.com, your one-stop shop for everything multifamily. See you next time when Jake and Gino share more of their investing secrets with you.